Welcome to the Space Show, Rick.
Thanks for having me.
What brings you here to Australia?
Well, we were actually going to be able to do a tour of the film, Mission Control, The Unsung Heroes of Apollo, going to several cities, and I was able to make the trip here to Melbourne for the opener last night.
Okay, and this film is based on a book.
Yes, sir. Yeah, it's based on my book, Go Flight, The Unsung Heroes of Mission Control. It came out in late 2015, and I cannot begin to tell you how happy I am with the response to the book.
And what's the book called?
It's called Go Flight, The Unsung Heroes of Mission Control.
And who are the unsung heroes?
They're the people who worked in Mission Control during the Apollo era. The shuttle era. I've been able to get to know some of the people who worked in Mission Control, and they really are ground-based astronauts. They care very passionately, very deeply about the space program, and they really do consider themselves the first line of defense in human spaceflight.
Many people would not be familiar with the vision of Mission Control, but perhaps they've seen the movie Apollo 13, and they saw the guy in the white vest. Who was that?
His name is Gene Kranz, and he's probably the most legendary flight director NASA has ever had. But one of the reasons that I wanted to write this book, and this is no disrespect to Gene at all, but I wanted to know that there were other people on that team who helped save Apollo 13 in particular and who worked so hard to make spaceflight a success in general. I wanted them to know who people like Glenn Lunny and John Aaron and Cy Liebergott and Jerry Bostick. There were tons of people who worked in that room and made it their career to work in human spaceflight.
And when did the flight director legend start? Was it back in the Mercury days in the 1960s, or was it later in the Gemini program?
Well, Chris Kraft was NASA's first flight director, and he certainly is more than a legend. He created the concept of Mission Control. And so I kind of call him the godfather of Mission Control, because nothing really happened without his approval and say-so. Dr. Kraft was certainly the first legendary flight director, and then along came John Hodge and Chris Kraft and and Gene Kranz and Glenn Lunny, and they really opened the doors for us to get to the moon.
How essential was their job in deciding what happened during a mission and even before that during the mission planning?
Oh, there's absolutely no doubt in my mind that what happened in human spaceflight would not have been possible without the people in Mission Control, because somebody had to look after the systems on the spacecraft, in particular the mechanics of the spacecraft, but they also had to have people who looked after the trajectory of the spacecraft. The people who worked in the trench in Mission Control, they were the ones who basically aimed the bullet and made the spacecraft go where they needed it to go. And the systems people looked after, they were kind of the mechanics. They were kind of the plumbers in Mission Control. They fixed, the guts of the spacecraft.
And how much autonomy did they have from the hierarchy further up in NASA?
Well, certainly the flight director had final say on every issue. His word was law during the Apollo era. I like to call them the flight directors. They were in charge, and even the president of the United States could not have overruled the flight director during a mission. It was that serious a position,
and very responsible. Did they feel the weight of that responsibility on their shoulders?
I don't know that you would call it necessarily feeling the weight. Certainly they knew that they were in a serious business, but they had to be unflappable under pressure. And I think that was approved through their intense simulations. Basically, the job of a simulation person was to kill the astronauts, and it was the mission. It was the flight controller's job to figure out a way to save those astronauts, to correct what was going on. And they learned that under very intense pressure during simulations, to the point where during a flight, it became almost routine. It became almost boring because, you know, more times than not, nothing was happening. You know, nothing serious and life-threatening was happening, was taking place. You know, and certainly there were cases like the launch of Apollo 12 where the vehicle was struck by lightning, and the flight of Apollo 13, which most everybody knows about. Where they had to put those training simulations into practice, and they had to put it into practice very quickly.
Does Mission Control still operate in much the same way today in the, well, during the shuttle era and then in the post-shuttle era?
Oh, absolutely. One of the greatest thrills of my career, I actually got to sit a shift in the International Space Station control room, an overnight shift. And it was amazing to me to see just how professional those people are, those men and women who work there are. I remember one of the issues that was taking place on the shift that I observed. There was supposed to be a Russian press conference with the cosmonaut on board. And right up until, you know, just moments before that broadcast was supposed to start, the TV link was not working. And so it was really fascinating to see the interchanges between the guy sitting next to me, who is actually in charge of the TV downlink, and his Russian counterparts. And it was just so absolutely professional how they worked those issues. They never became unglued. They never seemed like, you know, the world was caving in. They didn't panic. They just worked through the issues and went on about the business of putting on a press conference.
I've heard a test pilot say that in a crash situation, he doesn't say, "Oh, I've got 1 minute before I die." Instead, he says, "I've got 1 minute to save this thing."
Well, that's exactly how a flight controller and a flight director in Mission Control think. You know, one of the great lines that Jerry Griffin, one of the longtime flight directors in the Moker, he said on Apollo 13, he never once considered the possibility that they would want to lose the crew. He said, we kept working out on the issues. We kept working on the consumables. We kept working on the trajectory, and we never run out of options. We never ran out of possibilities on things that we could do. Now, he said, obviously, it was touch and go there for, you know, a couple of days after the accident. But he said we never ran out of options and never panicked. And, you know, I wish that I had that kind of mentality.
Most people will have seen the movie Apollo 13. How true was that to the spirit of what happened? I mean, obviously they made cinematic license in some areas, but basically how true to the spirit of what happened was that movie?
I'll say this. I think the movie Apollo 13 was very, very important in bringing NASA's space program, human spaceflight program, back into the American consciousness. That said, there are plenty of inaccuracies in the movie, and what's the best way to put this? What's the most appropriate way to put this? Gene Kranz did not work every single shift during the flight, because he's basically the only flight director who's portrayed as being on console. And, you know, obviously he had to go to the bathroom at some point. But there were plenty of men who worked in that room during Apollo 13 who helped save that flight. And as a matter of fact, one of the flight controllers who did work in that room actually challenged me when I was working on the book. He said, I want you to pull back the veil on Apollo 13 and get past the mythology, you know, of the movie. And I really had fun doing that. I had fun, you know, talking to the people who did that. And, you know, one of the most telling stories that I heard was from Ed Findell. You know, he said we came into work. He'd been playing a softball game with Jerry Griffin, and they were actually in their apartment, in one of their apartments, drinking a cold beer together when they got the call. And so he said, I was hot and sweaty. Jerry was hot and sweaty, and we came in to work in our sweat clothes, and didn't take a shower for the next 4 days. Bob Carlton said that he slept under a console during the flight. And there are just tons of stories like that. You know, just the absolute dedication to bringing those three astronauts back is just absolutely heartwarming. Because it kind of restores your faith in humanity.
The flight controllers and others in mission control, the unsung heroes that were there during the Apollo days, for most of them, how long did they stay on? Did they stay on during the Skylab missions and then the Apollo Soyuz and into the shuttle era?
You know, certainly there was some turnover. John Hodge and Dave Reed and several others at NASA left sometime around 1970 to go to work for the Department of Transportation. But, you know, Bill Moon stuck around and was actually the ECOM on STS-1, the first flight of the space shuttle. There were several, you know, Apollo-era veterans who returned for the space shuttle. Now, several of them were working in management by that time, but there were also several who actually, you know, were still sitting the consoles.
Another person in mission control is usually or always an astronaut. The tradition is that only the astronaut talks up to the spaceflight crew. And they're basically the interpreter between the mission controllers and the astronauts in space. How does that work?
Well, I think you put it very well. They were interpreters. They spoke the language of a fighter pilot, of an astronaut. So they spoke the same language. And you know, if you've ever sat in the cockpit of a jet fighter plane, you cannot become unglued at the first sign of trouble. And so that was the reasoning behind making an astronaut the person who actually communicated with the crew, because they did have the same personality, the same unflappable, you know, we got to do this kind of personality. But by and large, in only one or two cases was a capsule communicator not an astronaut, and I think they tried it out and figured out very quickly that, you know, maybe it was best to have the astronauts talk.
During the Mercury program, they used to send the astronauts to Australia to communicate by our ground stations.
Absolutely, at Carnarvon, there were actually several tracking stations around the world, and I don't know how you got chosen to be on a tracking ship, a tracking station on a ship in the middle of the ocean. I guess they lost a bet or something, because I don't know. I talked to, I think it was Bob Hesselmeyer, who talked about being on board a ship. Being on board one of the tracking stations on board a ship, and actually having to sail crews around a typhoon. Now, I would like to work on in the space program, but not in a typhoon Absolutely not.
And we know that Charlie Duke actually spoke to an Australian who wasn't an astronaut.
Well, there was a very brief time where the communications did go down, and while he was trying to get in touch with the crew of Apollo 11, and the tracking station here in Australia actually responded to Charlie and said and got the message up to the crew, and Charlie told a great story about that last night after the film. He said something to the effect of, you know, the tracking station here in Australia said, "Is there anything that we can do? Is there anything else that we can do for you?" And Charlie said, you know, if you could get us a couple of cases of beer up to the crew, that'd be great. And no, he said that to John Young. He was actually talking to John Young in the spacecraft, and John said, you know, "Can you get us a couple of cases of beer?" And obviously that wasn't going to be possible. But Charlie said when he got home after the mission, there was a case of beer sitting in his garage from where the tracking station had arranged to have it delivered. So, you know, there are just so many stories like that, so many awesome behind-the-scenes detailed anecdotes that make this what I do a true passion.
What got you interested in this story?
I wrote a book about the space shuttle program after Challenger through the very last flight, and as part of that, I got to do a tour at Johnson Space Center with Milt Heflin, who actually became my co-author on the Mission Control book, and he took me to the neutral buoyancy laboratory, which is this huge, huge pool where they do underwater training for the spacewalks, and that was awesome. I mean, it's the largest pool in the world, but they wouldn't let me go swimming. They wouldn't let me go train with the astronauts underwater. So yeah, it was nice to see, but you know. I thought it was cool, but you know, they didn't let me go swimming, so I had to, you know, just go on. But then he took me into the robotics laboratory, and I got to shake hands with RoboKnot and, you know, see him do all the things that he does.
RoboKnot is a robot that's now on board the International Space Station.
Yes, sir. Absolutely. And it was just amazing to see the dexterity that the thing had and the different things it was able to do. But then finally, he walked me into the old Apollo era mission control room, and I cannot begin to tell you how stunned I was, because I had only felt that overwhelming sense of history on a couple of battlefields of the American Civil War. I felt it in Dealey Plaza where Kennedy was assassinated. But I also felt it there in Mission Control, you know, because it became very clear to me very quickly that when Neil Armstrong said, "Houston Tranquility Base here, the Eagle has landed," he was talking to that room. When the crew of Apollo 12 was struck by lightning, when the launch vehicle was struck by lightning, the crew of Apollo 12 looked to the people in that room for a solution. When the crew of Apollo 13 reported, "Houston, we've had a problem," they were talking to the people in that room. And also, the last words that the commander of the Space Shuttle Challenger had were spoken to that room. And, you know, obviously we know that seconds later, the spacecraft broke up when the external tank ruptured. So I knew in that moment that I wanted to do something to get to know the people who'd worked in that room. But if I'd had a book, if I'd actually written a book for every book idea I'd ever had, it would fill up two or three warehouses. 6 months later, five or six months later, I happened to get an email from my editor, Colin Burgess, who actually lives here in Australia, up in Sydney, and he said, "Do you have any other book ideas?" And I said, Colin, it's funny you mention that, because I have this idea of been wanting to, you know, discuss with you to do a book about the folks who worked in mission control. And that was the easiest pitch I think I've ever made, because it was such a no-brainer to honor these people.
Yeah, there hasn't been much written about them ever, has there?
Well, Chris Kraft has written a book, and it was very well received. Gene Kranz wrote a book that we all know, and both are great books. But when they're written by one person from one person's perspective, that's all it is one person's perspective. And I wanted to write a book that would tell people about as many of the people who worked in that room as possible. And in the end, I interviewed over 50 people who worked in mission control, in and around mission control. I interviewed a handful of astronauts, but only as it pertained to their duties as CAPCOMs. I did not talk to them about their flights or their experiences as astronauts in flight. I just solely wanted to talk about their work in mission control.
Yeah, yes. So what new perspective were you able to bring to this narrative?
I think the number one thing that I discovered about these people is the absolute dedication that they had and the passion that they still had for human spaceflight years and years and years after they last sat a console. One of my most favorite memories, one of the most meaningful things that's happened throughout this entire process, I actually got to sit in mission control with Bob Carlton, who was the control officer during the landing of Apollo 13. He was the one who was watching over Eagle's fuel supply as it very quickly dwindled. And we sat there for probably two and a half hours in mission control, just me and him. And if you know Bob, Bob likes to talk. And he's a sweet old man from Alabama, so he has this just absolutely amazing Southern accent. If you think I talk Southern, you've not heard Bob Carlton speak, because he has the absolute perfect Southern twang. But he told war story after war story. He actually, he was over 80 years old at the time. I think he's 87 now, so he would have been 84 at the time. This has been 3 or 4 years ago. But he sat there and he drew a detailed map of Eagle's descent engine and just explained everything that it did. And I'm not an engineer, so I didn't understand half the things that he was saying. But I can only hope that I have as clear and vivid a memory as he does when I'm 55 years old and he's 85 now. I mean, he is as sharp as a tack. Yeah. So that was one of my favorite memories of this whole process. Ed Findale, who is absolutely one of the most awesome people on the face of the earth. He's very direct. He's a no-nonsense guy. If he feels like he needs to give you a hard time, he's going to give you a hard time, and he's given me a hard time many times. But he was so passionate about this project that I was doing a section on the flight plan for Gemini 4, which was the first American spacewalk. And they actually put that flight plan together behind locked doors with an armed guard outside. And the flight plan was classified top secret. And Ed actually went and got his copy of the Gemini 4 flight plan and made photocopies of it and gave it to Milt, my co-author, who sent it to me. And you know, to read that document is just absolutely fascinating, you know, because on the front cover it says top secret, you know, don't open until launch day plus one. So that was another. But to pick out, I could sit here and talk all day about, you know, just the truly meaningful memories that I've had over this whole process.
To find these guys, was it very hard? Did you have to travel all over the states, or are they mostly still living in the Houston area?
Well, actually, one of the neat things that happened was when I got to one person, I would interview them, and almost invariably, they would say, well, you need to talk to so-and-so. Well, I've been trying to track them down. Do you know how I can get in touch with them? And so once that started happening, it really snowballed. And as I gathered, you know, those contacts, and I did my interviews, I think I gained some credibility, in their eyes, that I wasn't just, you know, some space fan, you know, just wanting to chat them up and, you know, to be close to them. You know, I was doing serious, what they considered to be a true serious, you know, project on them. But those contacts, you know, really started snowballing. And in only one or two cases was I unable to interview somebody who was still living that I tried to get to. And, you know, they weren't, you know, I really wanted to interview them, but for some one reason or another, I couldn't get to them. The one person I didn't get to interview who had already passed on was John Llewellyn. He actually died a month or two before I first visited the Moker and this whole idea began. But John was just absolutely an extraordinary character. He had actually fought in Korea during just some savage battles, and he had severe post-traumatic stress syndrome, and he really dealt with that for a long time. But I don't know that there was another flight controller in that room who was as respected as he was, you know, for all the stories that there are out there about John. He was very well respected, because once he stepped through the door of that Moker, he put all those issues behind him. You know, there was no more Korean War, and maybe that was some comfort for him. I don't know, but in his eyes, I truly do believe that he felt like he was still fighting a battle against the Russians. As a matter of fact, I want to say it was when Alexei Leonov did the first ever spacewalk. John actually went to Glenn Lunny's house and started banging on the door and said, "John, we got to go. Glenn, we got to go to work. The Russians are beating us again." And so, in a very real sense, I think John was still fighting a battle.
Who publishes your book? And how is it available here in Australia?
Absolutely. It was published by the University of Nebraska Press. It's part of the Outward Odyssey series on human spaceflight. And certainly you can order it online. You can get e-copies. The audiobook is available on Audible and iTunes and all those kinds of venues. I love the audiobook. The audiobook is very well done. You know, the reader does a great job of pronunciations, and you know, some you can't say that about. They tend to kind of butcher what they read, but that wasn't the case, because I actually got to work with the narrator a little bit and you know, advise him on, you know, some of the pronunciations, and we went back and forth over several things. So that was a neat process. But yes, absolutely. You can get copies here down under.
After the book, you got into helping with the film. How did that come about?
I can honestly say now that I truly know the meaning of the word no. Because I pitched this project to several people. I pitched it to several agents, and basically got told we're not interested. And finally, it came to a point where I just didn't think it was ever going to happen. And I was introduced to Keith Haviland, a businessman and entrepreneur in Britain, who has a great passion for human spaceflight. He has one of the world's most elite space collections, of memorabilia. And was introduced to him. One thing led to another. We met in Houston for the first time right before Thanksgiving in 2015 for a research trip, where I introduced him to several of the people who worked in Mission Control. And I honestly think when Keith came to Houston for that first trip, I think that he meant to just throw a few dollars at it and make a nice little tidy, film. But I think that Keith came away from those meetings absolutely, completely blown away, like I said, by the passion that the people still had for human spaceflight. And so he got back to the UK. He put together a budget and got some investors involved. And we started filming. We did the first filming in June of 2015. Spent about 2 weeks going around Texas to interview several of the people. Did another shoot in Houston and New Jersey late 2015. We finally got permission to shoot in the historic Moker in early 2016. And we had the first public viewing of the film at Space Fest in Tucson in June of 2016. So it was actually a very short process.
MOCA being?
The Mission Operations Control Room, which is the NASA name for Mission Control.
Yes, NASA's always full of acronyms. Had Keith Haviland been involved in any other movies?
Oh yes, absolutely. He was actually one of the producers on The Last Man on the Moon, about Gene Cernan, the Gemini astronaut and the Apollo 17 commander who was the last person to walk on the moon. And that film is just absolutely extraordinary. It is, before Mission Control came out, it was my favorite space documentary ever. Because it painted just such an intimate portrait of a person who's considered an icon. But Keith was involved in that, and I think that really lit his fire to do more films. And I fortunately was in the right place at the right time with the right idea with Mission Control. So we teamed up, and he brought Gareth Dodds, the producer, on board, and hired David Fairhead. And David and Gareth and Keith absolutely could not have put together a film that I could be any more proud of. I truly believe it's an extraordinary film.
Documentaries don't often get a cinematic release. Has yours been released cinematically?
Well, it's not a film that you can just pick up and go to. We've done several scheduled events. I did a couple of showings in my hometown in North Carolina that were very well received. It had its world premiere at a very famous film festival called South by Southwest in Austin, Texas. It was also, I believe, at Sarasota. And had a great reception there. Actually finished second at Sarasota to a film that received an Academy Award nomination this year. So I was very proud of that. And we also had a showing in Hartford, Connecticut that I went up and hosted myself. So it has been shown in public, but... the biggest one that we've done, actually did one at Space Center Houston for all the NASA folks, and to sit in a IMAX auditorium and to see your name come on screen and to see something that you've worked very hard on for so long finally come to fruition. The director of Johnson Space Center was there. All four surviving Apollo-era flight directors were there. Chris Kraft was there. Several of the people who worked in the room and their families were there. And for that film to receive a standing ovation when it was over, it was It was one of the most special moments of my career,
I should say. And now you've brought the film to Australia, and I've just had a tour around some of the bigger cities in Australia. At the Astor Cinema, right here in our broadcast area, how did the screening go there?
I cannot begin to tell you what it meant to me to be there in that theater. And it was absolutely a packed house. I don't know how many it seats, but there were very, 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 very few empty seats. And for people to laugh at the right places, for them to be very silent during the dramatic parts, I think it did what it intended to do, and to receive to hear the people clapping from the stage, that's a moment that I'll never forget. I mean, that, to know. I'll say this: I could never have imagined where I would go. Where it would lead me when I first stepped into the mission control room. I wrote the book, and I told the stories, and for those stories to still have impact 3 or 4 years after the book came out, you know, it means a lot to me, and that film is going to carry that forward. So, am I ever going to sell more books than J.K. Rowling? No. I would like to, and my wife would certainly like for me to sell half as many. But that reception that we got last night, and the true passion that the folks here in Australia have for the spaceflight program, it's why I wrote the book.
Most of the people there were just members of the general public, had no real knowledge of the space program. Many of them, well, I mean, some of them are even too young to remember the shuttle, let alone the Apollo program. But there were people who had traveled there from, I spoke to several people last night that had come from Adelaide.
Wow. That's just amazing. And, you know, to have Charlie Duke there, the 10th person to walk on the moon, to have Jerry Griffin there, who is one of the very famous flight directors during Apollo. He was actually the only person to lead more than one lunar descent to the surface. To see Charlie's reaction, I mean, he loves the film. You know, obviously, if he didn't think it was a worthwhile project, he wouldn't have made the effort to come here. So, it was a pretty special moment.
Yes, I just say that's quite a compliment to have Jerry Griffin. He was one of those film. He was actually in the film, and Charlie Duke, who was also in the film, come here and support this screening. Because if it had been a lemon, they would have said, "No, bye bye."
Yeah. Well, you know. And I think that speaks a lot for the true professionalism that went into the making of the film. It is not pieced together piecemeal. The special effects are beautifully done. You know, we actually had somebody ask how we got a camera in space to film the two spacecraft undocking. Well, you know, that's just a trick of the trade. We can't tell you. But that's how well the special effects are done.
Will the film get a cinematic release here in Australia, or are we going to have to look at the DVD? Or perhaps even go to one of the streaming services for it?
It's on Netflix now, so it's available there. For it to be released like the Avengers or like Star Wars or any movie like that, I don't know that that's ever a possibility. But if there's anything that I've learned, you never say never. You know, the tour here in Australia, it went around to several cities. you know, like Sydney and Perth. But for it to receive an Avengers-like release, it would take some doings because, you know, that just doesn't happen with documentaries.
Well, we do have some documentaries that do screen here in Australia.
Are you trying to tell me, would you like to sign us up?
I'd love to, but unfortunately I don't have the money.
Hey, you got a checkbook.
We can make it happen.
Are you working on anything new now?
I am working on a couple of things, and I was very fortunate because of my work on the Mission Control book. I was actually called and actually served as a consultant and extra on a movie called First Man about Neil Armstrong. And it stars Ryan Gosling as Neil Armstrong, stars Claire Foy as his wife, Jan, and several other very well-known actors and actresses. But I was actually able to serve as a consultant on the film and work with Damien Chazelle, who won an Oscar for his work on La La Land as Best Director. And I got to tell you, man, it was absolutely fascinating. Absolutely fascinating to watch him work. And it bothered me not in the least that he was born the year that I graduated from high school. But to see the absolute care with which he framed every shot was just, man, I cannot wait to see the film.
When will it be released?
Later this year, 2018.
Okay, in time for the 50th anniversary next year.
I think that's what they're shooting for.
Well, thanks, Rick, for joining us on the Space Show.
Thank you for having me. I look forward to coming back again.